You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this episode is presented by Rosalind English.
Hello, LawPod listeners, and welcome to 2025. It's always good to start the new year on an elevated note, and my guest today is Baroness Brenda Hale, formerly President of the Supreme Court until her retirement in 2020. Lady Hale is the only woman to have been appointed to the position of Lord of Appeal in the House of Lords, where she served until she and the other Law Lords were transferred to the new Supreme Court in 2005. Lady Hale has presided over a number of prominent cases, such as Boris Johnson's prorogation of Parliament over Brexit. And she's been a strong supporter of the campaign to change the law on assisted dying, referring in a 2024 lecture to the law that criminalised such humane interventions as cruel. No doubt you're happy to see the outcome of the debate on assisted dying in Parliament, Lady Hale.
Well, I was happy to see it in principle. I can't claim that the details of the bill are exactly those that I would wish them to be, but that's another matter.
Well, that's another matter, and it's at least a crack in the tent, an opening in the door. But we're not here to talk about assisted dying. Another big subject comes into view: freedom of speech and the privacy of the individual. You gave an address last year entitled Press Freedom and Personal Privacy, A Clash of Rights. Lady Hale, let's go back a few years and survey the establishment before the advent of social media. We're looking at the printed press and the broadcasting establishment, now known in some circles as the legacy media, because one time they ruled the roost, but today, arguably, they don't. So let me ask you, how did the great beer moths of the press come into conflict with the law in what we think of as our modern age?
Well, not so much into conflict with the law, but they found that what they had previously been able to do was no longer invariably permissible, by which I mean gross invasions of personal privacy of sometimes celebrities, but also of ordinary people. As you know, the best known example of that was a journalist and a photographer in the Sunday Sport basically invading a television star's hospital bedroom while he was recovering from very serious head injuries, and purporting to have an interview with him, an interview to which he was in no position to consent, and then publishing this as a great scoop. It was the grossest possible invasion of the privacy of somebody while he was recovering from brain surgery. Clearly, he hadn't been in a position to consent, and yet there was very little that the law could do to prevent this, or to give him redress after it happened. And so that was in 1990, that incident took place. And the Court of Appeal, all of the judges said, what a pity it was that they couldn't do anything to protect this person's privacy. I'm not sure that they were entirely right about that, but that was the view that they took, and they thought that Parliament would have to do it right. And then, I suppose, a decade or more later, things changed, and they changed because of two things, one of which was probably the more important, was that the judges began to develop the tort of breach of confidence, the legal wrong of breach of confidence, so as to attach an obligation of keeping things confidential where there was a reasonable expectation of privacy in relation to that information. And no countervailing good reason for publishing it. That was the major development. Attached to that was the Human Rights Act 1998, which obliged the courts to respect the human rights of individuals. And that included, of course, a right to respect for private and family life. Not an unqualified right to respect for private and family life, but a basic right which could only be interfered with in certain circumstances. Putting those two things together meant that we have now developed something called the tort of misuse of private information, which means that if there's a reasonable expectation that the information will be kept private and there is no countervailing public interest in publishing it, then it should be kept private. Now, this, of course, stopped the newspapers from doing just the sort of thing that they had been used to do before in the Sunday Sport case. And they didn't like it very much. This is not surprising, because everybody loves to have titillating private information about other people, whether they're celebrities or whether they're just ordinary people. That's what sells newspapers. And so they definitely didn't like this development. And it's one of the reasons why certain sections of the legacy media started referring to the hate of human rights.
I think it's safe to say that certain parts of the media are not too keen on the Human Rights Act, at least that part of it that ushers in the article of the convention that protects privacy interests. But may I take you back to your October lecture, where you quoted a question put to you: why do we have such a gutter press in Britain? Well, I mean, I suppose no prizes for guessing the answer to that, really, at that time.
Well, I was quoting a remark by another law lord who said, well, why do we have such a gutter press in this country? And this was actually around the time that we were beginning the new development. And he said it's because we have savage libel laws, which obviously mean it's quite difficult to tell lies about people, but we have limited or no privacy laws, which means that it is quite easy to tell the truth about private information. And that is why we have this press that concentrated so much on private information, which was true, rather than on other sorts of information which might or might not be. That's what his view was. Of course, we have now developed the law of privacy so that there is a remedy. But we've actually developed it in a very balanced way, because the other point about the Human Rights Act, which the press ought to be pleased about, is that it also protects freedom of speech. So what we now have is a calibrated law in which, on the one hand, you've got the right to privacy, and on the other hand, there is a right to freedom of speech. They're neither of them absolute rights. They're both of them can be interfered with for a good reason in a proportionate way. And so you have to balance the importance of the privacy right against the reasons that the media or anybody wants to invade that right and whether those are good enough reasons to do so. The main case in the House of Lords in which all of this came out was, of course, the case about Naomi Campbell. Although we weren't doing anything brand new, it had already started. But Naomi Campbell was photographed coming out of a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, which enabled the paper to say that she was addicted to drugs and that she was receiving treatment for it, and to sort of describe what the meetings of Narcotics Anonymous were about, and so on. Everybody agreed that this information was private information of the sort where there was a reasonable expectation that it would be kept private, because it was about medical treatment on a particularly sensitive area, and one where upsetting the treatment might be very harmful to the person concerned. So everybody agreed there was a reasonable expectation of privacy. But everybody also agreed that the newspaper was entitled to correct false statements that Naomi Campbell had previously made, saying that she wasn't addicted to narcotic substances. So they were entitled to put the record straight. But the question was whether they had gone too far in publishing what they published, the photographs and the actually readily identifiable details about where she was going and so on. And the House of Lords decided by a majority of 3-2 they had gone too far. I was one of the three. And what influenced me the most was the evidence of the harmful effect upon her and therefore her recovery process of this being made public, and particularly the knowledge that somebody must have disclosed to the newspaper so that the newspaper could send along a photographer or whatever, or somebody could send along a photographer. So it's a good example of a balancing act between the various considerations. But there's an even better example, of course, later in my lecture, which I could talk about if you'd like me to.
So, Lady Hale, the stress and sense of betrayal and consequences for the mental health of Naomi Campbell was something that weighed with you when you were making your decision in that case. I'm thinking of another case that you referred to in your lecture, where there really was a possibility of psychiatric harm to a child if freedom of the press prevailed, as it did, over privacy. I wonder whether you could take us through that case.
Yes, indeed. It was a very, very sad case. It involved a little boy of 8 who had an older brother who had died in mysterious circumstances in Great Ormond Street Hospital. And it was eventually decided by a High Court judge that the child had died as a result of salt poisoning by his mother. His mother was suffering from something that used to be called Munchausen syndrome by proxy, that is, an extension of a Munchausen syndrome, which is that you either pretend to be ill or actually fabricate symptoms of your own illness in order to get medical attention. Instead of doing it to yourself, you do it to a child. You either pretend there are symptoms or you fabricate the symptoms. And that was what the situation was. As a result of the family court judge having decided that the mother had poisoned her son, the mother was charged with murder. And her trial was due to take place in the Old Bailey over a considerable time. And the question was whether it was open to the court to prohibit the newspapers from publishing the name of the mother, at least while the trial was going on. And the reason why the child's guardian, who was looking after the surviving child's interests in the course of the family court proceedings, wanted the name to be kept confidential during the trial, was that there was evidence from a child psychiatrist of the potentially damaging effects upon the mental health of the little boy to be subjected to daily, as there was likely to be, publicity about his mother and the death of his brother day after day, if not in the national press, in the local paper where they lived, which had already published a lot of stuff about the case, and the potential for his being teased or bullied by schoolmates or ostracized by schoolmates or whatever. And in any event, the long-term effects of these terrible events upon his mental health. And so there was quite a strong medical case for keeping the mother's name secret, at least until the end of the trial. Different once she was convicted, and it would be a one-off event and it wouldn't be the drip, drip, drip over several weeks. So when it got to the Court of Appeal, I was in the Court of Appeal in that case. I mean, I set out the balancing of the various factors, the child's right to privacy and indeed to protection for his mental health against the freedom of the press. And the other two judges agreed with the principles, but they didn't agree with me that they came down in favour of protecting the child. I'm afraid you'd expect me to come down in favour of protecting the child, because that's what I spent a lot of my professional life trying to do. So off it goes to the House of Lords. And the House of Lords are really very strongly in favour of press freedom in this case. They seem to think that it was absolutely essential for the name of a defendant in any criminal trial to be made public. Now, I'm kicking myself somewhat because it is very common in continental Europe for the name of a defendant to be kept confidential unless and until there is a conviction. It's not universal, and there can be exceptions to it, but it is quite common. In other words, it is thought that the public interest is obviously in observing the trial, in reporting on the trial, in making sure that the trial is properly conducted. All of that is incredibly important. But actually, putting a name to the defendant is not necessarily thought so crucial. And I don't think I spent enough time explaining that and researching that so that it might have had a little bit more of an effect on the House of Lords, but I think it wouldn't have done. I think the House of Lords took the view that this is one of the sacred cows, basically, of the British criminal justice system, that we always have to know who the defendant is unless the defendant is a juvenile. The protection of the child when the child is a defendant seems to trump the freedom of the press, but the protection of the child when the child is basically a victim is not regarded as so important. So, I mean, I regard that case as important because it laid down the principles and it laid down, you know, neither right trumps the other. It is a balancing exercise and you have to look at all the factors very carefully. All of that is right. I just regret the fact that the protection of the child didn't loom as large as I thought it should have done. Of course, I have absolutely no idea how that child is now doing, because one of the terrible things about being a judge is that you do your best to make the right decision and the right predictions, if predictions come into it, at the time, but you don't necessarily know how things turn out in the long run.
It's interesting that you refer to the civil law position and that perhaps if there'd been more of a comparative law input in that case involving civil law jurisdictions in Europe, maybe things would have gone the other way. But I agree that freedom of the press and transparency of criminal justice proceedings seems to be something that is unlikely to change. I wonder whether you'd mind me taking you back into your career a little bit further, Lady Hale, and you spent 9 years at the Law Commission instigating and bringing out various serious changes to the law. What are you most proud of from those years?
From my years at the Law Commission, I think undoubtedly the greatest achievement of the team and the team in what was then the Department of Health and Social Security, with which we collaborated, was the Children Act 1989, because this was unusually a piece of legislation which was able to bring together all the law about the care and upbringing of children, both within families and by local authorities, if for some reason they had to intervene either to support or remove the child from the family. It could all be brought together in one place. It meant that all the principles were coherent, well, hopes, and certainly the same. Before that, different courts had had different remedies, different principles, different outcomes, all sorts of different procedures. It was just madness, really. You know, if you went to a magistrate's court, you had one set of things to prove. And if you went to the High Court, you had a different set of things to prove. And the outcomes were different. So it rationalised the whole of that area of the law and has, on the whole, stood the test of time pretty well. I think I can say that. So, yes.
And, of course, famously, the novelist Ian McEwan wrote a novel named after your act, The Children Act, and that all concerned the refusal of treatment by a Jehovah's Witness teenager.
He was 17 in the book, and I think that was the difficult question about, can a court oblige a child to have treatment to which he is fundamentally opposed? To which the answer was yes, but of course the outcome wasn't necessarily, again, in the long term, what one would hope it to be. I mean, the book is a very good book because it gives a pretty accurate picture of the sorts of cases that come before High Court judges in the family division. And in a way, the film is even better because Emma Thompson gives a tremendous performance as a High Court judge. The only thing that's wrong, I mean, apart from the private life story, which is that's something different, is that this one judge seems to get all the sexy cases. And frankly, you don't get all the cases. You get an awful lot of cases which are all of them interesting individually, but raise the same sorts of problems. It's unusual for one judge to get not only the case about the conjoined twins, but also the case about the 17-year-old Jehovah's Witness and so on. And this judge gets all the plums.
So that, of course, that's the novelist's prerogative. Just going back to black letter law, wearing your law commissioner's hat, and indeed your judicial hat, do you think there are some areas where statute is not really appropriate? I mean, where in fact it should be left to the common law?
I'm sure there are many areas which it is very difficult to put into statutory language the nuances of what you want to achieve. And you can only put it into statutory language, which is so vague that it doesn't really help. The best example of that is the law of illegality, the effect of illegality on contracts or liability in tort. We have had a debate over many centuries about what the effect of unlawfulness in the course of contractual dealings or the performance of a contract or affecting what would otherwise be a tort. Lots of debates about how that should go. And in relation to contract, the House of Lords said, well, if you have to rely on an illegal transaction in order to make your case, then your case automatically fails. But if you can make your case without relying on the unlawful transaction, well, then your case succeeds. Now, that's fairly clear, but it can operate in a pretty random and arbitrary way, depending on the facts of the case. So there was another point of view that said, well, we have to look at the precise illegality involved. What's the reason for it? And is that reason affected by other reasons which might favour upholding the transaction? In other words, let's make the law just and coherent in the particular circumstances. An example of that was a case involving a teenage girl who had been brought from Nigeria to work for a family in London, and she had been promised wages and education, accommodation. Now, in fact, she came on a visitor's visa, so she wasn't allowed to work. She was treated incredibly badly by the family for whom she came to work, because she was, of course, in a very vulnerable situation. She eventually managed to escape, and she brought proceedings against her employers, sounds like almost the wrong word, but anyway, her exploiters. Now, she wasn't able to sue for the wages she hadn't been paid because she wasn't entitled to work. But she was allowed to sue for the fact that she'd been discriminated against because of her vulnerable situation, because there was no good reason why they should get away with treating her so badly just because she wasn't supposed to be there. And so she did have some remedy. In fact, these days, she would probably also have a right to be paid a fair amount for the work that she had done, because they had profited from her work, obviously, looking after the house and the children and so on. And they shouldn't be able to benefit from that without paying a fair sum for it. And the fact that she wasn't supposed to be doing it shouldn't really have prevented her getting up. So that's an example of the balancing of the various factors. And that was in a case called Hunger and Allen. And that, of course, was in total contrast to the rule about if you have to rely on the illegal transaction, you can't get a remedy. Because, of course, she would have had to have relied on the illegal transaction. So it all comes to the Supreme Court to try and sort out this discrepancy. And it's sorted out in a case called Patel and Mirza. Well, I say it's sorted out. The difference of opinion is sorted out. Not sure the problem is sorted out. Mr. Patel and Mr. Mirza made a deal that they would engage in a conspiracy to conduct insider dealing in some bank shares because one of them expected to have the inside information. So the other one paid over £500,000 for the purpose of investing in this illegal transaction, expecting to make a big profit. As it happened, the insider information wasn't forthcoming. So the unlawful betting never took place, or betting, trading, never took place. And so the man who supplied the £500,000 wanted his money back. The answer was, oh, yes, but the transaction from which the money was paid over was illegal. It was a conspiracy to commit insider dealing. So you can't have your money back. In fact, the Supreme Court decided that it would take the more flexible approach, the approach in the Nigerian case, rather than the stricter rule-based approach. And in any event, because he didn't have to rely on the transaction, all he had to say was, well, I paid over this money and the purpose for which it was paid never happened, so I should get my money back. So he got his money back. So that's an example of something that'd be really, really difficult to put those principles into statutory language. So the Law Commission, not during my time, much later, took the view that it was something that the judges could sort out. And I think that is a good example of something which the judges could sort out. But of course, the way it was sorted out probably makes the outcome in any individual case less certain than it would be if it had stuck with the rather more straightforward rule that was espoused by the people who eventually didn't succeed in the Patel and Mercer case.
Of course, predictability, which is the advantage of things being in civil codes or statute law, versus flexibility of the common law has always been the choice. And I don't think there's going to be any particular change to that. Lady Hale, I won't detain you for much longer. We've had some very excellent examples of what you've been talking about here. But I won't be forgiven by my fellow presenters, or indeed large part of our listeners, if I don't ask you about diversity and the place of women at the bar, in the judiciary. Your stellar career is one thing, but how do you feel about the way the land lies now? Do you think there should be a considerable improvement?
I think there has been a considerable improvement. That's not to say that everything in the garden is rosy, but we have had a dramatic increase in the representation of women in the judiciary at almost all levels, and it tends to be getting better all the time. The problem still is, but it's a problem that many professions have, which is attrition, so that women go to the bar or become solicitors, and then between 15 and 20 years seniority, there is a greater, dropout's the wrong word, but greater movement out among women than there is among men. And this means that, therefore, in the more senior ranks of the self-employed legal profession, women are still underrepresented. There are ways round that, of course. Both the bar and the solicitor's profession can do things to make it much easier for women to take breaks or step sideways or whatever, and they are thinking about how to do that. The other thing, however, that we tend to forget is that a lot of the women who step away from self-employed legal practice go into employed legal practice, because it is so much easier to manage in many ways. And so they go into the government legal service, local government, magistrates, advisors, commerce, finance and industry, in-house counsel of various sorts, where roughly 60% are women. And some of those jobs are, of course, incredibly important and high-powered jobs, you know, like general counsel to the Bank of England, things like that. So women on the whole do very well in that area of operation. So the focus on self-employed practice as a barrister or a solicitor, I think we should broaden our focus, and we should also broaden the pool from which we recruit the judiciary, and in particular the senior judiciary, because there are many very able and dedicated women out there who would make very good judges, but we've got a rather sometimes narrow view about what qualifies somebody to be a judge. I would say that, wouldn't I? Because I didn't spend all my time at the bar. I spent most of my time as a university teacher and then a law commissioner. And so I would think. And the more senior woman in the Supreme Court now didn't spend all her career at the bar. She moved from the bar into the government legal service and then parliamentary clerks and then various tribunal appointments. So there are other ways of getting to the top in the legal profession, but we ought to be a bit more flexible about it. So that's one of the things. The other thing that's still very shocking is that there is a gender pay gap in the legal profession. Again, I'm talking mainly about the self-employed legal profession as opposed to in-house counsel, where I think things are a little bit, I hope things are a little bit better. But there is plenty of evidence that women are still being charged out by their chambers at a lower rate than men for exactly the same sort of work, and that not enough women are being given opportunities to appear in the highest court. One of the shocking things about the two cases brought by Mrs. Miller in relation to the whole Brexit operation was that in one of those cases, there were loads and loads of people appearing. Only one of them on their feet was a woman. And in the second case, there were nothing like as many people appearing, but none of them were women. There were plenty of women sitting behind, you know, feeding the men with the information that they needed or whatever, but not on their feet. And so there is still stuff to be done, and briefing practices and charging practices at the bar is part of that. Let's not be too downhearted, because although there are these things that still need to be addressed, and I haven't mentioned everything, obviously, things have improved really quite dramatically in the course of this century. And that's because eventually the powers that be began to realise that there might be a problem and that therefore something ought to be done about it. And that's always the key to making progress.
Thank you so much for that interesting summary of the current situation. Anybody interested in exploring this particular subject further, of course, may I advertise my co-presenter Lucy McCann's excellent survey of women in the law in her International Women's Day podcast. But Lady Hale, thank you so much for making time to come on to our platform and talk about the interesting subjects that we've covered. And I hope that you will be happy to come and talk to us again.
Oh, well, no promises. No promises. But this has been very enjoyable. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This episode of LawPod UK was presented by Rosalind English. The series is produced by One Crown Office Row.